we only have about 35 minutes, and I have about 80 questions, so I'll try to go through them fairly quick. But I think you have some slides you might have to work through.
Yeah, so I'll use some of it with our two-page safe harbor statement, if I could. I want to tell you that some of the comments I'm going to make today are forward-looking. As such, they're subject to some risks, results, and they may differ materially in the future. There's more information available on the AT&T and DirecTV's website and SEC filings. And gosh, those SEC filings are riveting. You want to read them. They're very exciting. So please use that as a reference as well. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ben, John. And maybe you can start out by talking a little bit about your background and what you're focused on these days.
So my background, up until about 2.5 years ago, was turning screwdrivers and doing operating things. And I've had the blessing in my career to do a lot of different things on the operating side, both in the network and various sales channels, as well as stints in the technology side, CIO and CTO. So I've had a chance to kind of plow around most of the engine of the business at different times of my career. And then 2.5 years ago, came into this job, and responsibilities primarily are about developing a long-term strategy for the business and doing corporate development M&A work. In addition, there's some things that we do within the company that are relevant to all the lines of business that we operate that we have some responsibilities for, and that includes doing some of the program management to make sure that we're getting the right cadence across all our lines of business of transitioning the business to IP and getting off older technologies, launching the in-flight communications business, what we're doing around acquisition of content, and most of our merger integration work for the various acquisitions we've done.
So to get right into it, where do you think the industry is going to be 5-10 years from now, and what's AT&T's strategy to kind of grow faster than the industry and grow profits?
So, the industry is a really good place to be, and you are all very well aware of what's driving a lot of this, which the disruption that's occurring because of the fragmentation of software. We believe that our role in this disruption is to continue to provide connectivity. And the great thing about the options that are coming forward to people in this virtualized software-driven environment is that more utility is occurring that requires connectivity. The cloud itself is driving quite a bit of a different change in traffic patterns, including upstream bandwidth that's now growing incredibly rapidly. And when you're in the connectivity business and moving information around, we think that's ultimately a good thing for the growth of our business. As more devices are able to connect into networks and people find the need to be connected and want that more pervasive connectivity, that's incredibly important. Our view is our continued place and our value proposition is to play in connectivity. And so while software continues to fragment and there's more capabilities brought out there and there'll be continued evolution and revolution in the software space, we want to be the best at connecting people to the software assets that they need to use to run their life. And we want to do that in a very pervasive fashion. We've always had a very attractive marginal cost structure. We've always had a very attractive ability to aggregate endpoints, and we think that's still important moving forward in the future. Access is a mainstay of this business, whether it's wireless access, wired access, continues to be very, very important. And investing to make sure that we maintain that competitive position and offer that superior connectivity is fundamentally where we want to be. Growth in the wireless business will be higher than what we see in the wireline business on a consolidated basis. We expect that the business will grow in the low single digits. We obviously expect the wireless business to grow faster than that to offset some of the slower growth in the wireline business. But we think they're both critical to have together for the long haul, especially as the tail between the wireless cell site and the customer continues to shrink. Backhaul and infrastructure associated with that becomes more important to run these scaled networks in the future. And that's why we keep these assets together and think they're so important moving forward.
So, not to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like your network is a huge core competency, having that access network, and you're going to invest in it, I would think, strongly. How does your networks compare the wireless network and the wireline network to the competition, and how are you really going to evolve that the next couple of years?
So we're very pleased at where we are in our wireless network. We've spent a lot of time over the last few years investing at top levels in the industry to get it to the best performing wireless network, we think. And we've seen unparalleled, the customers are telling us this. You look at our NPS results, they're the highest they've ever been. at the direct correlation of where our churn numbers have been. The network is performing extremely well on the wireless side, and we're not done. We continue to work and refine, and there's more to do, and there's several big evolutions coming up, not only spectrum auctions, but shifts in how wireless networks are architected to enable for customers to do what they want to do on a mobile basis, which is largely consume entertainment, which is bandwidth intensive and requires scaling. Our enterprise business is a leading business. We obviously have a share position and a customer list that's second to none in the industry. And we continue to be very, very successful in ensuring at the top end of the business market we have the right serving architectures and product capabilities and our networking features to enable that. If you look at where we've been in the cloud space, our emphasis has been on our net bond strategy, which is ensuring that our leading position in the market on VPN can get customer workloads into the virtualized environment, whether a customer wants to work in a private environment, a semi-private environment, go to a public cloud environment like Amazon or into Microsoft or other places and still get all the robust features, security, quality of service capabilities that come with that. And we're very pleased with how that business is growing, and it's what's driven that strategic services growth, you know, at 14 or better percent over the last several quarters. In our consumer business, you've seen probably the last several weeks, you know, a spate of announcements around our Gigapower launches, which is our intent to deploy gigabit Ethernet in our consumer environment, as well as pick up some of the smaller business segments in those builds as well. And this comes out of some of the work we've been doing in a few trial markets, specifically in Austin, looking at how the market dynamics have changed. Given that we now have a structure out that allows us to do more targeted builds and also allows us to look at different deployment strategies around how we pre-sell to find out where there's willingness to buy and ultimately be able to penetrate markets faster. And a combination of how we're marketing the product, the reduction in costs associated with the first cost of deployment starts to make this business model look quite attractive. We started the fiber to the node strategy back in the 2005 timeframe. I think we indicated that this was not the last investment we'd make. Our goal was to continue to move fiber closer to the customer. That was the logical next step for us to do at that time. Much of that investment now in some of the first areas we deployed is over 8 years old. That business case was largely built on 5-year paybacks for the first tranche of investment we did, and it's time to start looking at taking the fiber the next step closer to those customers. And we like this business model. We're happy we're doing it now. We not only get the architecture of being able to deploy gigabit technology as opposed to technology that would have been used in 2005, that would have been around the 300 meg level, but the costs of it are lower. We also think the business model is far more attractive in terms of how we go forward on this. And so we will be investing to make that next wave of bandwidth capable into the consumer market. And we're going to be timing it, as we can do now, with the arrivals of the revenues, the needs of the customer to have that higher bandwidth.
Great stuff. I have a million questions, but at a high level, how will consumption of entertainment change 5-10 years from now, particularly on the wireless front? You know, we talked about multicast television. How will it change from how I'm watching TV now? What will it look like 5-10 years from now?
So, I mean, inherently, customers want to be able to watch and entertain themselves wherever they are and under their terms. And, you know, the reality of the industry today and how content is licensed and sold is it doesn't fit elegantly into that model, and it's taking some time for it to evolve. I believe that the customer desire to do this is pretty strong. There's a willingness to pay, and so I do believe the model is going to change pretty dramatically. I think as markets mature, so when you're in the kind of the handset and tablet space, and if we go out 3-4 years and growth starts to slow on net adds for that, doesn't mean that we don't still continue to see growth in machine-to-machine in other areas. But as customers have equipped themselves with their mobile devices, a basis of competition is going to start to shift onto other terms. And we know that what customers want to do with their mobile devices is they want to entertain themselves. You know, we've done all kinds of studies. We've watched customer behavior. We've done cohort work to allow people to do what they want to do with the device, and the first thing they want to do is entertain themselves. And it's largely video and to some degree music that drives the traffic over the network. So our belief is that because of that, it's important that we understand how customer buying decisions are going to be linked to content over time. And just like today, a number one influencer of a customer's decision around why they buy broadband is linked to their television services in their home. I think over time in the mobile space, there'll be a tighter link to aspects of what kind of content people can consume and how easily they can get at what they want to watch. And so part of our DirecTV objectives here are not just to lower our cost of content in the traditional linear space that we buy it, although it's incredibly meaningful in terms of what it generates for cash flow and the ability to take that cash flow and reinvest it in the infrastructure I just mentioned by deploying more gigabit fiber. But the other piece of it is that to have scale in the community to be able to work on the evolution of these consumption patterns and how customers want to see content. And mobile content consumption will have some characteristics that are same of what people do in their homes today, but it will also have characteristics that are different. Short-form content will become more important and more valuable. The shift to the golden days of TV and the value of TV content is because it's shorter form. There will be even more short-form content that's shorter than TV episodic content that starts to evolve in the mobile space. Working with the people who are the really good folks at generating that quality content and ensuring it comes to pass will be really, really important. We don't see the death of linear as we know it today to be an overnight phenomenon. It's not going to happen that way. But we do absolutely believe that the linear construct will change to some degree. People will become a little bit more discretionary in how much of it they buy. Some will maybe not buy it at all. And it's going to be supplemented with other models that are emerging, more over-the-top and flexible models. And those over-the-top and flexible models will naturally play very well into a mobile environment. And so we want that scale with those content folks to be able to play in that. Our investment in the Churn and Group is designed to make that happen. That's where outside of the running the linear video business, we're getting the creativity and the business model innovation that makes sure that we're relevant there with those supplemental capabilities. But we still believe that scale in the core traditional space is important as the foundation to start from.
And just to step back a little, as you develop these capabilities, which will be, I think you'll be at the forefront of this globally, can you export those same capabilities internationally? I know international over the last couple of years, it seems like there's been a little bit more of a focus. Now you're going to have an operating business in Latin America with DirecTV. Could you see the company expanding into Europe and Latin America a bit more over the next couple of years?
So on the content side, I don't know that I would necessarily say those models cross borders exceptionally well. In fact, one of the things we like about the Latin America TV business is the content regimen down there is a little bit more rational than it is in the U.S. There's a little less leverage right now for the content owners in terms of how they get stuff out there. And we think that'll probably stay that way for a period of time. And the reason that's the case is because the dynamic of how customers consume and what they're watching is a little bit different. It's not to say that there aren't things that we can learn from how we develop customer solutions and innovate on the product side that the technology and execution might not be transferable. But I don't know that just because you buy content, you do something with somebody in the U.S., directly means that you're going to get this wonderful scale or synergy that translates down to Latin America. Now, set aside content, just talk about, do we think that there's a business to be had down there? If you go back 2.5 years when I came into this job and some comments my supervisor made to audiences like this and my own discussions, I think, when I've been out publicly on a limited basis, we clearly set out one of our objectives at AT&T was to try to diversify our revenue streams beyond strictly being U.S.-centric, and that we felt getting revenues that came from outside the U.S. as being really important to us. And we talked about where we thought there was attractive places around the globe where we could take our learnings and what we knew how to do in the U.S. and export it and be successful. We talked specifically about the fact that we thought Europe was a good place for that. We commented that Latin America was a good place as well, but made the note that we had a partner in Latin America at that time that we had a passive equity investment in. We talked about the fact that we really weren't that enamored with Asia or Africa. What's changed is through the DirecTV transaction is we've been able to move from a passive investment posture in Latin America to an active investment posture, and that's not an insignificant move for us. We're excited about that. It opens up a whole other place, a whole other set of spaces on the chessboard that previously, because of our construct, we weren't able to necessarily pursue. And it's a great market, as we said earlier, 2.5 years ago. It's many more people into the middle class. That's good for growth and those kind of products and services that we sell. Their needs are becoming more complex. And so we're very interested as we get down the path with DirecTV, we get confidence that we're going to close this thing, to understand what else we can do to drive additional growth. And those numbers and the percentages obviously are a lot more attractive than what we can do organically within a more mature market, a profitable, a more mature market like the U.S.
So on DirecTV, I forget the exact number, but I think we've modeled in about $1.5 billion of content synergies. And I think you guys have commented, given some numbers out there, but how confident are you in the ability to get synergies of lower prices on content as an integrated DirecTV AT&T company?
I think within the context of our assumptions on why we did the transaction and the valuation, we're very confident. I think we made what I consider to be some very achievable and conservative assumptions on it. We're not expecting we're going to set new price points in the market for content. That's not our assumption. Our assumption is that we're going to be successful at maintaining the price structure that DirecTV has established in the market for all of our video subscribers. Said another way, that DirecTV pricing for content moves to the base of AT&T customers that we have today. And we think that's achievable. We also believe that there's an attractive proposition of why it's a win-win-win for everybody involved. Obviously, we want to manage our cost structure and generate more cash. That's a win for us. But we think it can be a real positive for the content industry as well. We're talking about models that broaden distribution, that bring mobile more into play, that allow us to do different things to get their content seen in different ways and grow their businesses as a result of that. More advertising impressions, more incremental subscriptions, and the capability to supplement with over-the-top. So we see this as a distribution play that can help them grow their businesses beyond the traditional linear model. And the third thing is, and this has been empirically demonstrated in some of the filings we've already made on the transaction, you know, there's a lot of notable economists that believe that the construct that we're talking about in the industry will slow the rate of growth in pricing. And so the customer is going to come out with not only more choices about how they consume their content, but we believe it'll be a more competitive industry that has more gating factors on the rate of growth that's been going on in pricing. And that's ultimately good for the consumer as well.
So on the DirecTV side, well, you have talked about the ability to bundle in the satellite with LTE, both for voice and maybe even broadband in some rural areas. Can you talk about, would you have the ability to shut down some of your most rural copper lines to replace with LTE satellite, kind of triple play product, and will you be aggressive in going outside your territory with that offering?
So I think it's important to understand the linkage of this strategy to what we had previously communicated under our VIP plan. And when we spoke with you about our VIP plan, we clearly indicated to you that our intention was to take our less dense areas and build a state-of-the-art IP wireless network and use that as the landing space for our less densely populated voice services and serve them through that infrastructure in an effort to be able to shut down that legacy plant, manage our costs, and get ourselves in a position where the wireline infrastructure was being managed in the nucleus of the metropolitan areas and invest aggressively to build state-of-the-art gigabit capabilities where it makes sense to do that. And by default, in doing that, we knew that there was a segment of our population where we were saying we probably were not on a path to investment in broadband in those more rural areas. And that's how we felt the financial equation over time would play out. What DirecTV has now allowed us to do is to take fallow assets that we have. When we buy spectrum licenses, they're not neatly drawn around where our customers are. They give you a big area, and some places you pay a lot to handle a metropolitan area, and the license still covers places where people aren't or there's cows. So we have a lot of fallow spectrum in some of these more rural areas that while we have to use the full license in the metro, we have not used anything close to that level of spectrum out in the rural. And with the way the LTE band standard is evolving with 4x4 MIMO, different power levels and a dedicated antenna, we can actually deliver a very attractive speed into these homes at a very attractive investment profile. Why it's attractive with DirecTV is twofold. One is satellite, and in particular DirecTV, over-index and share in rural areas. So there's a lot of customers who like satellite services. The second issue is by being able to show up with a professional installation where you have to put a dish on a house and to place a fixed antenna on that mast to allow for the sale of broadband into the home is just a great advantage from a SAC perspective. It lowers your acquisition cost. And when you put the two products in the household, it drives churn down. And then from a revenue perspective, because you have an active broadband connection that you're now managing, homes that were underserved by broadband previously have the opportunity to gain access to on-demand content. You can begin pushing targeted advertising into the set-top box through the new technologies that are available and drive ad streams that you couldn't do in that base as well. And so it's just a natural match that this is the right trigger to do this at this point in time.
And will you be aggressive with that product?
Absolutely. You're not going to make this investment without being aggressive, right? We're excited about it. And I will tell you, our initial announcement on where we're building is predicated on the spectrum licenses we hold today. We have auctions coming up. We're going to buy more licenses. There'll be collateral damage in some of those licenses that we buy. We're going to end up having to buy a footprint that maybe was bigger than where we needed the spectrum. And if we get additional areas where we have that fallow spectrum that just come out of where we had to buy it, we'll certainly look to possibly expand that footprint.
And what type of speeds do you think you can get with that more fixed wireless type product?
So we've been very conservative in what we've discussed publicly because we don't have these out at scale. We're doing this largely based on lab data and engineering calculations. And we said sustained rates during peak at 10 to 20 megabits. Peaks could be higher than that during non-peak periods. And frankly, you know, depending on what our assumptions are on penetration and how much more spectrum we throw at it, we could potentially do more. We feel comfortable with that speed level when you look at the distribution of broadband services in the segments we're talking about serving. There's a substantial number, a little less than probably 25% or so, that are served by no terrestrial broadband. There's another chunk of them, probably about 30%, a little bit less, that have very slow-performing DSL-type services. And then the vast majority of what's left are usually served by non-upgraded cable plant. So we're not talking about 750-megahertz systems with DOCSIS. So we think that that speed profile, especially with a great video offer on it, is very competitive for the next 4 to 5 years. And the nice part about this is not a capital-intensive business case, and the paybacks are pretty quick, and so that raises our confidence level.
So is this a good product for 20% of U.S. households, you think, 30%, 10%?
Right now, it's a good product for about 10 to 12 million U.S. households.
Okay. Very good. Are any real regulatory issues with getting the DirecTV deal done? Where are we in the process?
Other than we need the DOJ approval and the FCC, there's none.
Have they raised right? And how are those discussions going? Have they raised any real obstacles that are insurmountable?
I would say they're going well. I mean, we're pleased at where we're at. It's obviously very early in the process, and there's a lot of the process to go through. And we're not naive that those are usually difficult processes to work your way through. We feel good about what we've seen so far. We feel certainly a lot better than where we sit today than we did at this point in the T-Mobile transaction. We think there's incredible value to the common customer as a result of this. We think it's good for the industry. We think it's a good investment story. We think it's a great marriage of complementary products that means a better set of choices for the customers in the market. The facts are very strong and on our side from that perspective. And so we think the construct so far and the dialogue has been incredibly constructive. There hasn't been anything that's come up in the dialogue thus far that we go, wow, we hadn't thought of that, or that was not an issue that we didn't expect would be raised. And we feel like we put a very compelling story out there and a very compelling set of investments that regulators should look at and say this is something they want to improve and move forward.
It's very logical. On the NFL contract, I think it could be one stumbling block in getting the deal done. Where are we in that process, and is there any kind of limit on what DirecTV can agree to pay the NFL getting that contract done as part of your transaction?
Well, DirecTV has said that they're very confident they're going to get the deal done, and from their representations, we're very confident that they're going to get the deal done. And I'm not going to get into details around our contracts and what's in there, but we're smart people, and you know, we go about these transactions to create value for shareholders, and if we felt that there was some confines we needed to put around something to make sure that that value was delivered, we'd probably be wise enough to go and negotiate things like that.
Very good. And you talked about LTE Advanced, but I haven't heard too many people talking about it, but obviously you being an engineer would understand the technology and running the networks for a long time. Is there a benefit to combining your wireline network with the wireless? Because from what I understand with LTE Advanced, to really take advantage of it, you want a lot more cell splitting, and obviously having your wireline network ubiquitous, will you plan to leverage that?
So I don't know that I would necessarily just say that LTE Advanced is the trigger for the value of having shared infrastructure. I think the value for having shared infrastructure is the simple notion that fiber is moving closer to the customer. And that's not unique to a wireline network. That's exactly what's happening in a wireless network. If I go to my early days, we started building wireless towers. You know, we had 8-mile radiuses around them. That's when you couldn't carry a call for more than a mile. But, you know, now we're down to less than 3-mile radius. You know, it's just north of 2. That radius of the distance between the customer's handset and their point of jumping on the wireline network will continue to shrink. And if you really want to go out in time and start to think about the end of the decade, and you look at spectrum positions and you realize that there's a fixed amount of spectrum that's going to be available, licensed or unlicensed, and you start to say what kind of technologies do you need to deploy, you're going to have to probably work your way up into the higher portions of the spectrum bands. You're going to start using different technologies to use that to find adequate enough spectrum to deal with the capacity. And that's going to suggest that you're really going to be dealing with very short distances between the end user and the cell site or the small cell. And so when you get into that strategy, having a wireless wired footprint, including GPON deployment, which is a great symmetrical technology that's inexpensive, relatively speaking, to put bandwidth on, I think is a tremendous advantage to build those kind of scalable networks so people can do what they want to do. And I believe that cost structure, if you're in that position over time, will become, it's not only pronounced today when you look at access costs as a percentage of cost of goods sold, it will become even more pronounced. And so one of the reasons why we believe it's right and it's the good time to start deploying passive optical technology on a more pervasive basis is to also position ourselves for a broader and denser cell grid going forward. So, yes, you'll see more of it just because of LTE Advanced driving more usage, but I think this dynamic has been underway for several years and will continue to probably accelerate.
So as you're building out these gigabit networks, are you putting futures in place so that you can use light poles or certain higher structures eventually to put more smaller cell sites in?
So, you know, there's getting right of way and how you go about doing it, what kind of constructs. I mean, I wish I could articulate to you just how many permutations there are out there. And, you know, this is a huge country. I think maybe some have underestimated just how hard it is to engineer a wireless network and a country this expansive and this vast and the kind of density characteristics that we have, which are very different than places in Asia and elsewhere. And we do a lot on that. I mean, when we're in working with the city on Gigapower, we're trying to find ways to get collaborative right away where we can place small cells. And we have made a lot of progress around that. But to tell you that we have a perfect ubiquitous footprint that we could go in anywhere we wanted and be confident that we could get rights to access or place, I would tell you, I'd be blowing smoke if you believed I could make that happen. You look at what we've done, I would say we've led the industry in our access into dense venues, sporting venues, large high-rises. we've done a lot of work over the last several years. It's one of the big reasons why our network quality is as good as it is. That's hard work. I mean, every single one of those is a very difficult negotiation with the property owner, and it's hard work to deploy an engineer. It takes time. So I don't think this work is over. I think it will continue to be important, but we've demonstrated that we can lead. We can be out in the forefront on it. Getting that real estate and that right of way is a strategic advantage, and that's one of the reasons why we're now turning around and selling access on those systems we deployed, just like you would sell special access or transport. We're selling access into those distributed antenna systems in buildings and in venues so that other people can get on and use it and charging lease rents for those as well.
So when do you think LTE Advanced will be deployed, and what kind of speed increases can we see?
Well, you're going to start to see the first parts of it coming out late this year, and certainly it'll be starting to hit the mainstream next year as everybody gets to concatenating non-contiguous spectrum bands. And it depends on how much contiguous spectrum you're concatenating to bring it in and how aggressively a particular carrier chooses to move to, you know, newer antenna technology. I expect the antenna technology moves will be a little bit more deliberate. They'll probably be more geared on normal replacement or triggered replacement if you have to add a new radio band or something wears out and you need to replace it because it's weathered and old. But, you know, when you're going to start seeing devices seeded into the mainstream, you know, late this year and starting to really take off next year. And, you know, frankly, as that starts to occur, depending on the carrier and the aggregation of the spectrum, it's entirely possible that you could see peak rates double over what people are seeing right now.
And I think you bought a bunch of spectrum from Qualcomm that's perfect for doing multicast video. Can that handle 10, 15 channels, you think? And can we start to see that product up and running in a year?
So the spectrum, depending on how aggressively you want to compress, could do that. And obviously it depends on some of your propagation characteristics and how you design an engineer. And you should expect that you'll see us begin to roll out multicast capabilities as we move through next year. And initially we'll be doing it on a targeted basis, and we'll be doing it in some specific areas where we think there's immediate deployment. I would tell you, clearly one of the thought processes we have as we get a little bit more scale on the content side and normalize our content agreements, that we would like the flexibility to use that technology on a broader application.
And on Project VIP, you've been upgrading, I believe, to 45 megabit speeds. Can you talk about how that's going and what percentage of U-verse now have those 45 megabit speeds?
Yeah, we're over, I think we're just north of 60% of the base that's 45 or above. And we're doing really well. I mean, I would tell you our flow share numbers in areas where we've deployed U-verse are, you know, very, very attractive. And I would offer that if I go back, you know, to 2005 and 2006 when everybody said it will never work. You know, I'm really proud that we've got markets right now where our share is starting to climb to the 40% level. And that's 40% of all TV providers, not just 40%. And I think that's really a good news story. So we also believe that there are markets where that will run its course. We're going to have to go beyond that. That is what Gigapower is about. And it's not just about getting the downstream speed. The dynamic that's occurring in the market is the growth of the upstream traffic. Virtualization and cloud is driving it. Upstream traffic is growing at nearly double the rate of downstream traffic. Granted, we start from two different bases on that, much smaller base of upstream traffic. But you're clearly starting to see applications shifting and driving more upstream traffic. We have venues today when it's a very social-driven experience, concerts, big football games, whatever it might be, where the upstream traffic coming out of a venue is greater than the downstream traffic going into the venue. And that's an artifact of the social dynamic that's occurring. It's an artifact of people uploading images, pictures, videos. And so we believe that getting that upstream robust is important. Gigabit deployments do that. They provide you with a great, much better symmetricality. We actually think that that's very, very attractive compared to competing with DOCSIS systems that run into difficulty with node splitting and the limitations of upstream that are inherent in HFC networks, and that we're going to see a drive and an investment as a result of that.
Do you think you can deploy dual-mode SSID Wi-Fi routers like Comcast is deploying?
So I think that dual-mode routers and, you know, public-private has its application. I'm a little mystified about the residential orientation of that. I fully understand why people would look for areas of aggregated and concentrated traffic to build those kind of opportunities, but Wi-Fi handoffs and Wi-Fi signals are inherently difficult to manage. I don't consider it to be a good customer experience when you're walking around the exterior of your house, walking up the street to your neighbor's house, and you're in the marginal area of a signal and your device is trying to pick which access point it wants to latch onto and it makes a bad decision, or at the moment you latch on to another access point, somebody fires the blender up in the house and drops the signal. And it just, in that environment, it strikes me as being a very, very challenging quality of service dynamic to manage if you're really trying to put a truly mobile footprint out. Look, incenting customers to use Wi-Fi when in their home, that's nothing new. It's been out there for a long period of time. Our customers generate the bulk of their data traffic in that dynamic, and they're going to continue to do that. And that's the most efficient way and the best performing way for everybody to do it. But I just don't quite get the dynamic that in a highly congested residential area, without the advent of a substantial amount more of unlicensed spectrum being made available, that you can manage a quality of service dynamic when you're on the fringe of access points radiating from the inside of a home to an outside of a home.
Well, I've gotten through about one-tenth of my questions, and we're out of time. I apologize, John. Thank you so much.
That's okay. I appreciate your attention today. Thank you very much.